continue on with entanglement now, since perimeter is such an entangled place. But the title's a little fuzzy. You'll see what I mean though in a second. So what I'm going to talk about is actually both things in classical and quantum systems. So I'll probably slip and use entanglement when I'm talking about a classical system. But there's something that's almost the same thing, I think, in a classical system that you can find called mutual information. So I'll describe some new results on that. And in particular, the results I'm going to describe, the common theme is we're going to be talking about a critical theory, and we're going to be talking about how certain universal subleading terms depend on the geometry. In some cases, these are log terms. In some cases, it's something a little more complicated. But that's the spirit. And because it's a critical system, you can have things that actually depend on the shape of the system itself. So in a gap system, of course, you expect the entanglement to be local, so it's only going to depend on properties of the boundary between them. But for a critical system, there's long-range interactions, algebraic decay of correlation functions, and so the way that affects the entanglement is these geometry-dependent subleading terms. And in particular, one of the nice things about this is that you can choose the geometry to make your calculational techniques work much better. And so let me give you an example with that. There we go. So that's just a torus. Numerical people like to use tori. We'll use both tori and rectangles. But so the torus split into two cylinders. But the thing about this geometry that's really useful for what we're doing, and I can't emphasize this, I can change the size of the regions or the aspect ratio of the two cylinders just, you know, by moving this, but that doesn't change the length of the boundary. And so numerically, that's a godsend, because what I can do is vary the size of the regions, but all the stuff, the area law pieces, all that other stuff in the entanglement entropy, you just can ignore. You just subtract off one point, and so then you're probing this geometrical dependence. And what I'll explain is there's a lot of interesting information in that geometrical dependence. And so before I go on, let me acknowledge my collaborators, who of course did most of this. So there's theory parts and there's numerical parts. And so the numerical parts done with our beloved leader, Roger, here, who's teaching now, or so he claims. So he's a convenient excuse. But anyway, he claims he's teaching. And anyway, with his, well, I guess then students, two then students and one about to be a then student, Ann, who's here, and Stephen Inglis and Haijin Zhu in various parts of the project basically did all the work. On the theory side, basically doing all the work is my postdoc, Jean-Marie Stéphane, for the stuff I'll tell you about first. And then various other people, I guess Miles is here. Where's Miles? Miles is here. And made lots of valuable contributions to the story. Okay, so I don't know if you've seen the movie or the book High Fidelity. You know, these sort of record store geeks make lists and things like that. And I'm that kind of person. And so if I had to make my list of really fundamental paradigms in entanglement entropy, there's actually, unfortunately, not that many of them. I'll leave the other ones ambiguous. You can try and write down your own list, and we can compare after. But one of them, I think everyone will agree, is a paradigm of entanglement entropy is this, actually quite old result. Well before entanglement entropy became fashionable, by Larson. I spelled Larson on you. Anyway, we'll check. And then it's amplified on by Giffre and others. And so what it is, it's the entanglement entropy for just a circle. My PowerPoint skills are limited, so I just wrote periodic boundary conditions up there. And you've got a region here, and you entangle it with there. So you just compute the Renyi thing. As long as we're working, might as well compute a Renyi entropy. So we've got the reduced density matrix, the log of the trace of the reduced density matrix to some power. And you get this magnificent formula. So it depends. It grows with the log of the size of this region. And that's an example of what I was saying at the beginning. This actually depends on, well, there's not much geometry you can have in 1D, but it depends on the size of this region. And in 1D, this has the fluke. This is the leading piece. That's not true in higher dimensions. It's a subleading piece. But anyway, so you get this formula. And the key thing, OK, it just depends on the Renyi index in a simple way. But the most important thing from the physics point of view is that that appears, if this is a critical theory, so that's why it's dependent on the log, then the thing that appears in there is the central charge. I should emphasize this is for a Lorentz invariant theory. If it's the theory is not Lorentz invariant, or at least not secretly Lorentz invariant, then I'm not sure what the formula is. I don't think anybody, anyone know of any formulas anybody's derived for non-Lorentz invariant cases? No, not asymptotically. Yeah, of course, there's some lattice model, but yeah, something that actually turns into, I don't know, actually.
Well, if you hidden there two different modes with different velocities.
Yeah, then. Yeah, then you would just add. Yeah, no, oh, in fact, that's good. That's the next prompt for the next slide. What's amazing about this formula, there's no Fermi velocity in this formula. And this is why this is an exceptionally useful formula. In fact, to be honest, I think this is the most useful formula so far that anybody's derived in entanglement entropy, because if you hand someone a 1D quantum system that let's hope is critical and hope is Lorentz invariant, we'll assume that those are going to be true, then you just simulate this and you just read off the central charge. There's no Fermi velocity. There's no fitting off bulk terms. So the other good way of doing this, and the way people used to do this, was to compute the Casimir energy and the energy, which is a great way to do it there. But then you've got a Fermi velocity, and then you've got to subtract off a bulk term, which makes your numerics much more of a pain. So this is much better to identify. So it's practically useful. Of course, conceptually, I think it's very profound well. And so let me explain. So this number, the central charge, many of you know, but is an exceptionally useful number from the conceptual point of view. And one of the things I'm going to harp on for the last part of the talk is it's a measure of the degrees of freedom of the theory. And for example, one of the things, it's the coefficient of Stefan-Boltzmann law of a critical 1D quantum system. So just see, so there's more, and this is the energy density, that's the temperature, so somehow C is telling you, in at least this sense, how much stuff is in there. And there's a famous theorem due to Zamolodnikov that there exists a definition off of criticality. No one ever really uses that definition because it's impractical to compute. However, but the important conceptual thing is that there is a definition that you can extend off criticality, and then you can prove using this definition that it goes down. So you use the conformal field theory definition at the critical point, and then you know this thing exists. So it's telling you it's a strong constraint of flows that are possible in 1 plus 1 or 2D theories. OK, so that's the central charge. And so like I said, this is the easiest way to extract it. And so this gives you hope, right? So now we want to move away from 1 plus 1D. Or away from these simple systems that we study and maybe find something else. And particularly the thing I'll harp on at the end of the thing is to try and find something that gives you a measure of the degrees of freedom. And it's a little subtle of what that precisely is, but maybe let me defer that to later on. But it's some sort of generalization of the central charge to critical theories in higher dimensions. But before we do that, before I go to higher dimensions, actually I want to stay in the same moral dimension. I'm going to go to 2D. I put 2D in the title, but that's why the title is a bit of a cheat. I'm going to talk about 2D classical critical points. And so they're described by conformal field theory. If in that case, Lorentz invariance is replaced with rotational invariance. Again, rotational invariance in the scaling limit. And to our surprise, no one seems to have asked before. Well, there's that beautiful formula I wrote down. Why can we not write down a similar formula for 2D classical systems? And so, well, that's what our work is. We showed how to do that. So let me explain how that goes. So Shannon's genius move, another one of the great genius insights, is that any time you have a probability distribution, you can define an entropy. Once you suitably generalize what your notion of entropy is, once you think about it, it's not even that much of a generalization. Anyway, so, and StatMech, this is all about probability distribution. So you just got some model. And the probability, of course, is just e to the minus beta ei, the Boltzmann weight, divide by the partition function to normalize it. And then you define an entropy. So you divide your thing into two subregions, just like you do in the quantum case. And then you define this sort of joint probability. So this is just splitting, say, the spins. Talk about spin system. So you just split the spins into some spins in region A and some regions in B. And then you sum all the probabilities over B. And then you get a probability for a configuration in A, no matter what is going on in B. So it's very much like the reduced density matrix in a quantum system. And then you define an entropy. And then what we like to do is define something where the bulk terms cancel off. So you take the entropy of this region A and the entry region B minus the union. Now, one thing, so there's what always seems to me a little bit mysterious, you know, entanglement entropy, when you talk about the reduced density matrix, it doesn't matter whether when you're computing these sorts of things, whether you take the reduced density matrix for A or B, so it seems still seems magical to me that those have to be the same. But on the other hand, this one is just manifestly the same. It's obviously symmetric. There's nothing fancy about why it's the same for A and B. We do it for A, we do it for B, subtract off the union. So it's, like I said, it's defined so the bulk term cancels, so you get this area law piece, what people usually call the area law. So I'm just doing two classical dimensions, so that's just the length of the boundary between them. That's a bulk piece. It's not usually that interesting because it's non-universal. But what's very interesting is the subleading piece. And we name the subleading piece for a critical system the geometric mutual information because it depends on the geometry of your system, and I'll show you explicit examples. And what's remarkable is that Jean-Marie figured out how to compute this in many situations, and I'll be precise. And why this is so nice for numerical purposes, again, we use like that torus geometry. If you use that torus geometry I showed before, you can vary the size of the regions without varying the size of the boundary, so you can basically just ignore that area law term, just look at differences. And so anyway, so this is the geometry that we used. It turns out, for reasons I'll explain in a second, this one gives a nicer answer. So instead of a torus, it's just a rectangle split into two regions, but the same idea. We've got a boundary between the two. Slide that up and down. And it's elementary. It takes only a few minutes. You can then think of the copies. We're taking trace of rho to the n, just like we do for quantum systems. So it's a Renyi version of the mutual information. There was an n on the previous. There we go. See the n is there when you put the densities in, sorry, the probabilities in. And so anyway, so then it's a few minutes. So what happens is you basically replicate the partition function. So there's the picture there. And that accounts for all the different copies of the probabilities. So rather than take a single probability to the nth power, you just write the probability out n times. And so you just follow this stuff through. And this is, again, pretty obvious to people who do these kinds of things. But there's one thing that's not maybe obvious. When you do this carefully, know that you're summing over. So the B's are the fan here. And so this is the different copies. This is what's giving you rho to the n. And so when you do this, though, you're fixing what's going on in A. So then you've got, when the energy is coming from region A, we've got n copies of those. So that effectively multiplies beta, the inverse temperature, by n. So you have to take the system at T over n. And so that's the one subtlety, which is easy to, I mean, it's easy to find, but on the other hand, it's easy to miss if you're not being careful. And so what we really want to compute is this object ZA, which is this partition function of the system on a fan. So we got these are independent, and then this system is not on a fan, but you have to divide the temperature by n. And then you just compute that partition function, and then you plug it back, these products again, because everything is manifestly symmetric. The things in the denominator are just the appropriate normalizations, again, for the n betas because of this thing here. So that's what you do. And so that's how you write. This is completely general. In fact, this is I drew it in two dimensions, but this formula generalizes to any model in any dimension for computing the mutual information. So what's remarkable, though, about this point about the temperature that I just emphasized is, okay, say we've got some model, Ising model, to make it concrete. We've got a critical temperature, the classical model. We know where the critical temperature is. But if I'm computing the mutual information, I get a critical point not just at TC. I do, because these systems are critical at TC. But I get another critical point when I set T to be NTC. So it gets critical behavior. This is not saying that there's some phase transition at T equals NC. It's saying in the mutual information, you get critical behavior. So saying the mutual information knows a lot about the system. So even if you're studying the mutual information where you set T to be NTC, it's telling you something about the critical behavior of the system. There's nothing wrong with that. That's additional information. That's not a... Anyway, so that's important to emphasize. And so here, yeah, this was essentially the philosophical digression I just said. In fact, if you could compute the mutual information for any n at a given t, then you can reconstruct all the Boltzmann weights. And if you know all the Boltzmann weights, at least in principle, you know everything about the system. This is a classical system. All the temperature does is rescale the Boltzmann weights. So it's all there. I mean, it's in a way, in a very vague way, somehow the Renyi index is somehow like a, it's like a doing a Laplace transform or something in the temperature. That's incredibly vague, and I don't think I have a good way of saying it, but I think morally that's the right idea. All right, so that's the digression, but let's compute it. So I said we want to compute the central charge. So here's the clever observation that Jean-Marie made. So we're trying to compute this fan here, okay? And so what the observation is, if the system is, let's think of a simple phase diagram. Just there's one critical point. Temperature lower than that, it's ordered. Temperature higher than that, it's disordered. Okay, so that's so then we can replace the non-critical part in our fan. So we've got a fan, and so say we set T equals TC. Well, then this thing is critical, but then this thing is ordered because it's in low temperature phase. And we can replace the effect of this ordered phase just with a boundary condition. Because we're taking the continuum limit, it's off critical, and so the only effect on the critical thing, because remember, all I care about is the critical behavior. So if I want this subleading term, all I need to know is about the critical behavior, and the only effect this system has on this is to basically this boundary condition, because this is in the ordered phase, it just fixes the boundary conditions on these n copies. So that's all. That's in the asymptotic limit, that's all you'll get. And then if you now want to set T equals NTC, which you're allowed to do, set whatever you want, but here, then this system is critical, but then this is in the high temperature phase. And so it's disordered. And so basically the effect is essentially no effect. It just has free boundary conditions there. So that's, we've reduced this problem of computing this very sophisticated sounding object to something really simple, which is a partition function in conformal field theory. So again, under the assumption that whatever critical points you're describing are conformal field theory, you get a formula. And this is a, well, I shouldn't say standard. It's not that well known, but it was done long ago, how to take a general conformal field theory, put it in this rectangular geometry. You can do this for the torus. In fact, the first thing we did was for the torus. You get theta functions and all sorts of the glorious stuff you get with conformal field theories. It's a nice formula, but what's really nice about this formula, you have to pick this geometry. So just the rectangle divided into two, and those are all the things there. Well, all you get is a formula is for that partition function. Remember, there's a log in that formula. So just the C in the formula, the partition function is up in the exponent. So when you take the log, you just get this. And this, for people who like conformal field theory, that's an eta function, what people in math call an eta function. I didn't call it eta because there's an I in the definition there. So that looks funny. So anyway, so that's basically f eta of iu. Anyway, so there's a formula. So this is manifestly geometry dependent. It depends on all these lengths here. But the amazing thing is the central charge is just a coefficient. And that's all. So you can compute it. And like I say, you get theta functions. The central charge is in there, but it's not so easy to extract. So we get our numerical friends to go off and running. And so they do. And so actually, it turns out the formula I just gave you there was for NTC. There's another one for T equals TC, which I didn't write down. It involves a dimension of the boundary condition changing operator, and I can elaborate on that if you want. But let's just look at the NTC formula. So the curve is just literally that thing. You know, eta functions are on Mathematica, so you just plug it in. And this is the data that these guys got just by doing they have this very clever trick called transfer matrix ratio trick that they figure out how to compute these things, and then look there. And so the slope, so that this is for icing case, and this is now just the subgraph is just plotting, just divide, it's cheating by putting that complicated function down there on the axis, and it works perfectly. You get C equals a half. And you might worry, well, I'm cheating because it's icing and everything always works for icing. So we did three-state pots. So the bottom one is three-state pots, and again, in N equals TC, and this one doesn't work quite as good, but it's pretty close. And again, so it's 4/5 to those of you who know conformal field theory. What this is what I mentioned before. If you take now icing at T equals TC in that formula that I didn't write down, there's a dimension of an operator in there, so you can actually extract the dimension of the spin field as 1/8 from this curve. So it works really nicely, and
well, yeah. Why is the behavior of the curve
Yeah, right, because, so it's familiar, so if, let me give a oversimplified answer, but if you remember, if you know what characters look like in conformal field theory, there's usually formulas for, say, the Casimir energy that look like C minus 24 times a, C minus 12 times the dimension. So actually it changes sign if the dimension of the operator is. And so the formula here is a little more complicated. I should have written it out, but it's basically that thing. So it actually flips sign. Yeah, no, I should have pointed that out. So it actually flips sign. So it's really a nice signal that we know what we were, you know, even before the detailed fit. I mean, the fact that the curve obviously flips over when you're looking at TC as opposed to NTC was a good sign. Okay, good. So, all right, so that's most of what I wanted to say about the classical story. We want to talk about it, real entanglement. And so I'm going to go through very quickly some results that actually predate this one, because they segue nice into another brand new result. And so there's a real nice story about certain 2D quantum systems that we dubbed at some point conformal quantum critical points. So these are fully two-dimensional quantum theories, but they're very special quantum theories. They're built such that the ground state is built from a 2D conformal field theory. And so what I mean is you now take your favorite classical model, say the Ising model, and so every classical configuration becomes a basis element of the Hilbert space of the quantum theory. And then you choose a ground state wave function such that the Boltzmann weight of the classical model is the weight in the ground state wave function, sum of all things. And so Hamiltonians that do this are called in quantum information world frustration free. In condensed matter physics, we usually call them Roxar-Kivelson. I tried at one point trying to have these things called free Hamiltonians, but it hasn't yet caught on. But I'll try again. I should put it in the slide to try again. Anyway. There are these special things built. So they're very special and they sound very peculiar, but some of the canonical examples of topologically ordered phases, like quantum dimer models or the toric code, are of this form, building this for this frustration tree, Roxar-Kivelson. And if we want to look at a critical point, which in a topologically ordered model would govern a phase transition from a topologically ordered phase to another one, then you would get one of these conformal quantum critical points. One of the ones that has a name that we thought up that did stick is the quantum Lipschitz field theory. So because they're built from these 2D conformal field theories, they have many relations. And so we set out to explore some of this. So we found a bunch of neat things, but I just wanted to highlight one thing very quickly, because there's a mystery I'm about to tell you about. There's no mystery on this slide. So in fact, the calculation of the mutual information in the 2D classical system that I just described is almost the same as trying to compute the entanglement entropy in these special theories. You can reduce it to a 2D conformal field theory calculation. And so that's what we did, and particularly Jean-Marie did. And so again, so this is now for the torus split into two cylinders, the geometry I showed at the very beginning. And so that's why you get a bunch of theta functions. That's what these things are. So this is for the second Renyi entropy. So the dots are the numerics. Haijin Zhu and did the Heisenberg case, which I'm not showing here. And then these curves are these exact curves you get from the conformal field theory. Now you get something unusual here, which is it violates strong subadditivity, which is okay because it's the second Renyi entropy. But you get an exact curve. So that's nice, and we were very happy and read some papers on that. But then the story went on. Okay, so we're very happy. It's one of the few exact results. But then, all right, so what do you do now for these non-peculiar theories? The ones where you haven't engineered a wave function to be really nice. Well, we don't know how to do these computations, or at least I don't. Max and Subir and others have done some of these calculations. But so Roger and Steven, so we weren't involved in this, just were doing the transverse field Ising model. They were looking for a bunch of things. And I don't know, one day, I don't know if it was Steven or Roger said, well, we have those thing on Mathematica, these crazy curves. Let's just fit the data to a crazy curve, and it fits almost perfectly. Well, one parameter fit. The only parameter they fit was the coefficient. I would be happy to babble about loops and 3D Ising to people who are interested in why this is so. But anyway, just numerical. So Jean-Marie then checked with free fermions. He's Jean-Marie can do these amazing numerics with free fermions because he's part of the part of the dimer racket. And so you do this for pi flux fermions, just compute the entanglement entropy, just fit it to that curve, up to only one parameter, just the coefficient of that curve. And we were so excited to begin with, but then when he just pushed the numerics harder and harder, and it's off by about 1%, and it's not getting worse. So you can see at large distances, both are converging, and they're close, but they're off by about 1%. So why a curve you get in this funny conformal quantum critical point is almost, but not exactly the same, we have no idea. So anyway, that's a mystery. That's what I wanted to mention. Well, the results from a few years ago, but then these now new results. So maybe some of you have some thoughts. But what I will tell you for the last 10 minutes of my talk will be another place in higher dimensions where we have some results. Okay, so let's go back. All right, so now I'm going back to the paradigm mode. So I like that result of the central charge in front of the entanglement entropy. So you might ask, where else can we see this? And again, these conformal quantum critical points, these funny 2D quantum critical points that have something to do with 2D classical critical points, you might expect a central charge to come up. And a place to look at is in corners. So now you put corners on your region in the entanglement entropy. And so it's a beautiful old result of Carding and Peschel's that generalizes a famous Katz result. So Katz wrote this famous paper in the 60s, Can You Hear the Shape of a Drum? And so it just says that, you know, you do something to the, if you can do anything you want to a free boson, the Laplacian, on the edge, can I then tell, so I can do anything I want, if I know the entire spectrum of the thing in the bulk, do I know what the shape is? And I think the answer is no, but it's close. I mean, it's you have to work hard to generate cases. You can't tell, is that right? Yeah, Mike, yeah.
There are cases.
Yeah, there are cases, but they're not easy to construct. I mean, the answer was not obvious for a while, but people did prove that there are cases. Or you have to find two cases that have exactly the same spectrum but a different boundary, but people did find these things. In any case, the thing about their formulas, what they showed is when you have a corner in your region, this is just 2D classical computation, you get a log contribution to the free energy in the system. And so what Carding and Peschel basically did was the free boson result, if you wish, of Katz, they generalized it to all CFTs. That's the result. And so, in fact, what this classical thing I showed before, this region, notice this was a rectangle, not a torus, so there's two corners there. In fact, that little bit when I flash that formula is the corner contribution. So it's there in the mutual information. And then not surprisingly, Fradkin and Moore showed that when you take these funny conformal quantum critical points, that term appears as a subleading piece in the entanglement entropy. And this is for a particular case where it's a 90-degree corner and the shape of region A is a rectangle. The form is more complicated. I admitted there's an Euler characteristic and all that. But in this specific case, it looks like that. So again, the central charge is coming up. And so this gives you at least a nice hint that if I were to look at this now for more generic systems, for just whatever your favorite two-dimensional quantum model is, the coefficient of the logarithm might be something interesting. And in fact, there's some computations that have already studied logs and things. So Cassini and Huerta have a beautiful result where they computed the coefficient of this log term in free field theory. And then there's also some beautiful results using the ADS-CFT correspondence, the famous formula of Ryu and Takayanagi, which is on my paradigm list, by the way, to compute these things. So they seem to be universal, and they seem to be nice, and they seem to have something to do with degrees of freedom. So let me tell you about our results now in the last 5 minutes. So there's another fancy technique that these guys came up. So you can ask Anne if you want to understand how this technique does, or Miles. Riegel, Bryant, and Singh invented this thing, the numerical link cluster expansion. So that's all I'll say about that. But it's a very fancy, sort of hybrid of numerics and a series expansion and all this, which gives you a nice way to compute the entanglement entropy. And one of the nice things in the setup, it makes it really easy to extract corner terms. So it's a beautiful technique for many ways. And so the model we all chose to study Initially, I was baffled to why, but I'll explain why this is a good model study, is a Heisenberg bilayer. So you just take the Heisenberg model and you put it on nearest neighbor Heisenberg model, so on two square lattices coupled, and then you just have this J perp that couples the spins on sites connected by a vertical link. So why you want to study the Heisenberg bilayer? The Heisenberg model of square lattice is boring. It's just, it's a nail ordered phase. It's got Goldstone modes, but it's not critical. But this gives you a parameter, the J perp down here. So we can vary the ratio. And as we vary that ratio, you actually get a real honest to God quantum critical point. You get an honest to God quantum critical point. So the quantum critical point is just the same quantum critical point that occurs in the classical O3 Heisenberg model. You got a low temperature ordered phase, and so that was with the staggered magnetization, so that would be the usual Goldstone phase you get for the Heisenberg model. But then as you turn up J perp, then this thing gets very strong and you get sort of a dimer phase. And so in terms of the planes, it's disordered. It's the ordering is only in between the two planes. And so the phase transition is just in the 3D classical Heisenberg model. So a bunch of people, I should have written down the names, have studied this directly in the quantum model, but on the lowbrow. So you say, well, once you know it's in the same universality class as the Heisenberg model, I can just write down the effect of action. It's just phi to the fourth theory. We'll describe this transition. And when mu squared is zero, you have a critical point, and that describes the transition. And like I say, it's been established very well numerically that these are in the same universality class and analytic arguments once. There was some confusion over whether there was two or three modes, but this one there's three because it's one gets soft at the critical point. So it's phi to the fourth theory with n equals three. It's field theory. Okay, so they did this computation doing this marvelous technique. So this first thing checks that indeed the corner contributions, which like I said, they can separate out, do depend on log L. And the different colored dots, there's actually two different ways of doing this procedure, and so a good thing that's a strength because then you do it both ways, and if you get more or less the same answer, you at least have more confidence that what you're doing makes sense. And so that's why the purple squares versus the blue dots were doing it the two different ways, and you see you get the same thing. So logs are hard to see, but I think that's pretty unambiguous. That's a log. These are all for the different values of the Renyi parameter that they studied. So one through two. So another benefit of this technique, you can just, the Renyi parameter just literally becomes a parameter. You don't need to fix it to be an integer. So you do that for a bunch of Renyi values and then extract that coefficient. All we want is the coefficient of the log. That's pretty convincing. So you just look now at the slope of the line and then you plot it. So this plot now has, well, four different things. Two are just the two different ways of plotting the Heisenberg bilayer or the O3 phi to the fourth result. But then, okay, the dots are what Cassini and Huerta did for a free field theory, 2+1 dimensions, just a free boson. Now, what the dashed line is earlier work by Ann and company, where they did the same calculation they did with the same technique for the transverse field icing model. This was particularly important because they benchmarked that versus other ways of computing the entanglement entropy. And so, so you have confidence that this NLC works. Anyway, so they did that, and okay, there's results. But here's the catch. To put this on the same graph, we divided the Heisenberg results by three. And you can see, it's almost indistinguishable the difference then between icing and the results you get for the Heisenberg model, the bilayer Heisenberg. So my collaborators make fun of me for using the word thrice, but it's a good old English word, so tough. We got the anyway. So to come back to the grandiose stuff I said at the beginning, what this does is this gives you a strong hint that coefficient in front of the log term in the entanglement entropy is some kind of measure of the degrees of freedom. Because in the icing model, you do the same Landau-Ginzburg argument. You, of course, just get phi to the fourth theory with a single component, classic Wilson-Fisher fixed point. And so for the Heisenberg case, it's a three component, effectively ends up being three components, an O3 model. And so thus, you get an O3. So naively, you might expect, if something's measuring the degrees of freedom, you get a factor of three. Now, so there's an important caveat. Of course, these are interacting theories, so it's not going to be strictly additive. If they're strongly interacting, it might not be anywhere near additive. But it's basically the same model. And when we're doing stuff in 3D, this is one of the nice things about 3D, is the Wilson-Fisher fixed point and the ON generalization of that. They're, in a sense, they're close to free. I mean, the epsilon expansion works. So to me, that means close to free. They're perturbatively close to free. So this is just the same plot over again. So the Cassini and Huerta results for the free theory aren't exactly the same, but they're pretty close. So saying we're an interacting theory, but in this slightly interacting theory, you still get this factor of three that you would get for non-interacting degrees of freedom. And that excuse I just made would have explained a fairly substantial deviation, but we didn't have that. So what that really says is if you were to compute this in the ON phi to the fourth theory, I hope somebody does this someday, compute this corner contribution, the leading piece would be proportional to n, and then the first 1 over n correction, just for whatever reason, turns out to be very small. So even n equals 3 and 1 is 2. Okay, so that's good. So that's my final slide. So the conclusion, obviously, most of them, there's sort of a bunch of obvious things you can do. One of the things I want to note, so in this calculation of the classical theory, I said, well, you had to be a order phase at low temperature, disordered at high. Well, the XY model, you know, isn't like that in 2D. It's a gapless phase throughout the superfluid phase. And so the formula for thinking about this boundary condition, so the formula relating it to these fans, of course, still works, but then using this trick with the boundary condition gets subtler. So it would be actually, I think, sort of interesting to try and understand how that worked. I think it's not impossible, but it may be tricky. And then there's some more maybe obvious generalizations, and I'll stop there. Okay, thanks. Yeah.
Does it map to some kind of interesting boundary critical phenomenon problem? I mean, you have all these kind of lines connecting together.
Yeah, well, that's kind of, so in the case I did, you know, that's why I picked this high temperature, because then it's an easy boundary problem. So I guess, yeah, so this one may be a too hard boundary problem. So what would be nice to do is if you can think of some way a system complicated enough so that you would get something interesting on the boundary. You could see like a flow between two boundary conditions or something like that by tuning some. So in other words, you had some multiple parameter in your bulk theory, but then reduced it to tuning some boundary condition there. But we couldn't quite think of anything how to do that directly. There ought to be some way. I mean, yeah, so, well, you know, with numerical people, you have to, you know, beg them to do stuff. But I tried just asking them to do hard squares, because there's a point where you don't know analytically where the critical point is, but already they get upset when you tell them that they have to numerically determine where the critical point is and all that. So we couldn't concoct something cute enough to get them excited yet, but that's where it may, well, maybe the XY models. But yeah, but that would be neat, and then you would be able to sort of use the full power of boundary conformal field theory, but it would show up in the information, which would be really kind of neat.
I see, but this fan problem is solvable?
No, it's not. That's we reduce the fan to these boundary conditions. So we got lucky. What Jean-Marie did was really clever. So let me show the picture again. Yeah, okay, so there's the picture. So the way it was is, so if you're at TC, well, this is ordered, and then you can just forget about everything here because all we're interested in the critical fluctuations. And so, okay, so that's easy. But now you think if it's NTC, what happens is, well, these guys aren't critical, but these are. Now you might think this is now some interesting boundary problem, but the catch is because this is a disordered phase, it's just free boundary conditions. So the fact that there's a fan here, this doesn't really notice it because nothing is telling what its spins can do there. So the so a scenario like what you're saying, what would be is now is the boundary condition, even though this is maybe some disordered phase, it still has some relic that couples all those fans together. So that would result in some neat boundary condition on this single conformal field theory.
So
yeah, that because
this
Yeah, right, because it's all just fixed and right. It doesn't matter whether but you can imagine something. Yeah, but you can imagine something interesting there. What if it was like, you know, fixed all up or all down, some linear combination, and then the copies would know each other, and so then you. So this should. This was just an example. You know, we've picked the simplest possible example. So POTS, even though it's strongly interacting, at least the boundary conditions in this case, you know, are nice, fixture-free. And so, but yeah, absolutely, there should be a way. I didn't think of one yet, but there should be one.
Yeah. Just about the fixed case, but it's not, so is it maybe an ordered phase, but it's not like at zero, right? So
All we're looking at, remember, so we're looking at so that would affect some subleading terms, but we're looking at just the critical behavior of the bulk of this critical bulk, right? And so all that feeds in fact, so at long distances, you know, effectively the other bulk, the non-critical bulk, you know, just sort of renormalizes onto fixed. So that's an assumption, but I think that's. Well, it worked too. So, yeah. But I think that's about as good an assumption as you can get. Actually,
any other questions? Then let's thank you again.